The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Mark Tudyk is a founding member of the Baltimore Consort, founder and leader of the Peabody Consort at Baltimore's Peabody Conservatory, where he is director of the Early Music Program, and a regular guest artist with a number of ensembles across the United States. He's also artistic director of the Indianapolis Early Music Festival, which takes place every summer. And he is in the studio with me to talk about the festival and his amazing career as a musician. How great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me, Suzanne.
So let's start with the Indianapolis Early Music Festival. What exactly is an early music festival anyway? You know, what kind of activities take place in general? Who are the participants?
Well, there are a few different types of early music festivals. Ours is predominantly a presenter of concert series. And in fact, we're the oldest continually running presenter of early music concerts in the country. We're gearing up for our 50th anniversary in 2016 with some very exciting events and collaborations. But what we do is present wonderful groups. We present the up-and-coming artists as well as some of the renowned groups from primarily North America, but occasionally Europe, when we have extra budget. Or we have a group from Europe who's already here touring. Mm-hmm. There are other festivals, for example, the Madison Festival, Amherst Festival, that are more pedagogically based. They have a large number of faculty members and 100, 150 students who come and take classes all day and eventually at the end of the week do a performance together of some major large-scale work. Mm-hmm. There's a workshop I do at Interlaken every summer where I'm the only faculty member, and it's usually about a dozen amateur players, some very fine amateur players, and we work on a specific program for a week and then do a performance of it at the end of the week. And then there are festivals like Boston and Berkeley that combine the two, pedagogical with a concert series, and have a week-long or 10-day-long kind of festival. Mm. And they also incorporate instrument makers displaying their works.
Hmm. Okay. So who were some of the performers, some of the highlights, I guess, at this year's Indianapolis Early Music Festival?
Well, every one of our concerts is a highlight. We just finished our first weekend, and Musica Pacifica opened the series with their Dancing in the Isles program, British Isles, folk and Baroque. It was very, very well received. And then Sunday, Quicksilver from New York City, Robert Mealy's group, performed 17th century Italian music, and it was just phenomenally beautiful performance. This coming weekend, we have the winner of Early Music America's Baroque competition, Palade Musica from Montreal. And they're also doing a program of 17th century music from all over Italy, Germany, and even a Polish composer that I'm really dying to hear, Jarzebski. I've never heard of him, and I'm Polish myself, so I'm very excited about this.
Wow.
And then I'm getting to be on stage on Sunday with the Baltimore Consort.
Great.
And we're doing a program called Crossing to the New World.
Ooh, so what's on that program?
It's a combination of British, English and Scottish country dances, folk tunes, ballads, and then some of the same ballad texts that survived in the New World and were discovered in the early part of the 20th century in Appalachia.
Now, I notice that a lot of the same performers and ensembles, I mean, you're a perfect example of this, playing in a number of different ensembles all over the country, but I notice that a lot of the performers and ensembles participate in multiple festivals in the course of a season. Is that typical, and how does that work?
Sure. Yeah, well, we all need to make a living, and we all love to perform, so there are players that work in several different groups. In fact, our first weekend in Indianapolis, I put together Musica Pacifica and Quicksilver because three of the members are in common for those groups. And at one point, four were. Mm-hmm. So I could present two different groups with two very, very different repertoires and not have that many airfares.
And I think, too, it seems that some of these performers play such unusual instruments and are real specialists. And they're sort of in scarce supply, so that probably feeds into that as well, no?
Sure, but that's changing. You would think theorbo players might be hard to find, for example, but now that instrument has gotten very popular, and even at Peabody, where I teach, there are some guitar majors that take it as a secondary instrument because they know you can get work if you can play the theorbo.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of raise a point that I wanted to ask you about, because you are a very active performer as well as a teacher, and you've had this wonderful sort of ringside seat to see how the genre has evolved and how enthusiasm for it has evolved and the training for it has evolved over time. Any perspective that you want to share about that?
Well, what you say is exactly true. The performing level in this country now is reaching what it has been in Europe, and it's very, very exciting. And we American musicians bring to it a real creative energy that sometimes is lacking in some of the older European groups. Many of the musicians go off to Europe to study, then come back here and tour. There's wonderful creative energy. And the real core of early music to me is what they used to do, which is improvise. Hmm. And we're starting to see that in more and more of the groups now that are that have the freedom to do that and know the style so well. Because, well, as you know, the composers of this music were the performers.
Right.
They didn't write it down for someone else to play or someone to study.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of classical musicians or musicians with classical training don't necessarily learn to improvise. So that's got to be a little bit of a hurdle, or maybe was a hurdle for musicians to overcome.
Yeah, I think still very few classical musicians learn to improvise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you personally, you play a variety of instruments.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sort of curious to know how you personally started in music and how you found your way to this genre.
Well, I was a guitarist as a kid, played in a rock group. Then in the 60s, I got heavily into folk music and folk rock. But then I heard classical music in my senior year of high school, classical guitar music, Julian Bream in particular, and I started playing. I found a teacher to work with, and I started studying classical guitar. And I wound up at University of Buffalo as a guitar major, and the music that I love playing the most was transcriptions of lute music. So after I got my undergraduate degree, I got a lute and started playing, and then found a teacher, coincidentally, in Baltimore at the Peabody Conservatory. And the rest is history. Mm-hmm. I was the last student to join the Baltimore Consort. It was then called the Elizabethan Broken Consort of Pro Musica Rara. Couldn't even fit that on a business card.
Well, that's an example right there of how early music has changed over the years.
Right. We wanted to be a little more audience-friendly and appealing.
The names didn't really trip off the tongue back then.
I just had a hard time saying it.
So do you think that there are still any misconceptions about early music or about the performers?
Well, I think the nature of performing it and as a really serious level, formal concept, I think that's really faded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure there are some people that still expect that, but you know, I think the attitudes have loosened up a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know I've had the good fortune to attend a Baltimore Consort performance, and, you know, as you say, it's musicianship is, you know, through the roof. It's fabulous. But there is an informality. There is a real improvisatory exchange.
Absolutely.
And it's just a lot of fun. It is very much like a folk kind of a concert. So is that something that was conscious, or did that just sort of happen because of the synergy between the performers?
It's both. Mm-hmm. It was conscious, but it was also, you know, we have such a different variety of backgrounds in the group, and everyone mm-hmm. wants to bring their own personality into it, and mm-hmm. we've been together for so long, mm-hmm. you know, we can kind of read each other's minds on stage.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting our 35th season. Mm. So it's a combination of things, and it's also wanting to, you know, to be more true to the style,
mm-hmm.
play it the way it would have been played. Now, we occasionally do some anachronistic things and enjoy some more modern influences, but mm-hmm. in general, we're just trying to do what was done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not playing from a four-part score, you know, where everyone has their own line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are improvising or arranging and creating parts that originally came out of improvisation.
Mm-hmm. Now, so are you comfortable talking about what those diverse backgrounds are
well,
of the
sure.
various performers?
Yeah. Well, Marianne Ballard, who does a lot of the research for the group, has an orchestral background. She was an orchestral viola player, and then went to university and became a musicology major. And I think she's probably what you'd call ABD, finished a doctoral program but didn't do the dissertation. She was too busy performing at that point. Ron McFarland was a rock guitarist, a very successful rock guitarist in throughout college, and then also was a classical guitarist. Larry Lipkus is a composer. He's had works premiered by the LA Symphony, Houston Philharmonic, you know, some major orchestral works. So he brings that to us. And some of the arrangements that we do are his kind of compositions almost. Mm-hmm. And who am I leaving out? I mentioned, you know, I have a background in rock as well as I played some jazz for a while, worked in the Virgin Islands doing nightclub work for 2 years before grad school. And Mindy, a wonderful flute player who has a classical background but also a very strong folk background. She does folk workshops all the time as a harpist, and she does a lot of harp playing.
Wow. So the students that you see now coming into a Peabody concert, do they have sort of a similar diverse background? Are they more likely to sort of have an earlier exposure to early instruments?
Well, absolutely. And just the fact that we have undergraduates who are already dedicated to early music is an extraordinary shift from the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. In fact, I have two students in the Peabody concert now that will be performing in Indianapolis later this summer. Brian Kay, a lute player who's just finished guest directing Apollo's Fire in Cleveland, and he's a two-time winner of the national competition sponsored by the Lute Society of America. He's the only two-time winner. He came in as a freshman. He was a couple years older, but he started as an undergrad. Now he's still at Peabody doing graduate work. And I've got a VL player, Niccolo Seligman, who is, I think, just turning 21, who's just phenomenally virtuosic. He started as a cellist and then immediately shifted to the viola da gamba because his teacher did both. And when he first heard her play the gamba, I said, oh, that's what I want to do. I think he was 13 or 14.
Wow. That's amazing.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. So these folks, what do you see their futures will be? I mean, it's obviously different. They're coming into it in a different place in the continuum. What do you think is in the future for early music?
Well, I think they're going to be doing what I'm doing. They're going to be doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that, mm-hmm. eking out a living. Mm-hmm. And if they're lucky, they might, if they want. I know the two I mentioned are not remotely interested in getting, you know, a full-time teaching position. Mm-hmm. They're just into playing, mm-hmm. and you know, they play other styles as well, and they improvise. Mm-hmm. So I think they'll have a fairly easy time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how far out do you plan the participants and, you know, sort of the overall schedule for the Indianapolis Early Music Festival? Do you know, for example, next year and the year after? Do you know?
Oh yeah,
what's coming up?
I've got next year already booked, and some of the highlights are Matthias Mauta is coming doing a solo recital, mm-hmm. and then staying, and the rest of the band is coming, and Ensemble Caprice will be there for the second concert. They're one of my very favorite early music ensembles.
Wow.
Wonderful group. And I've got Rachel Barton Pine coming and playing concertos on violin and viola d'amore with Indianapolis Baroque Orchestra. Trio Settecento from New York with that and Chicago that Rachel plays in is teaming up with David Douglas and Alan Hargis from the Newbery Consort, and they're doing a program of English 17th century music together. And I'm working on 2016 feverishly because that's our 50th anniversary, and we're planning collaborations with Dance Kaleidoscope. They have a program a choreographed to music of John Dowland. So I'll be putting that together with them. And I'm meeting, hopefully this week, with one of the actors from Indiana Repertory Theater. We collaborated in 2009 and I hope to do that again in 2016, a Shakespeare program. And that would be with the Baltimore Consort.
Wow. It's a lot to look forward to, and that's great.
It's very exciting.
It is really fascinating and wonderful to see how vibrant and how much collaboration there is now sort of across genres. And that also seems to be sort of a new-ish kind of a thing.
Well, yeah, it's an audience building thing. It's a great deal of fun. It's rewarding. But you know, I think the initial impetus is, you know, audiences are not that they're dwindling so much as that there's so many more activities now than there were. Mm-hmm. And audiences are spread a little thin. Mm-hmm. So if you can collaborate with another arts organization, it's, you know, to everyone's advantage.
Sure. And again, getting back to the authenticity aspect of it, it seems to me that the music would have been a companion for a Shakespearean performance.
Absolutely.
Or dance or whatever. So it makes really good, logical, authentic sense to do it that way.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the spirit that we're trying to recreate. You know, we're not, the Dance Kaleidoscope is not going to be doing a program of Renaissance dance. They're doing modern dance. They're a modern company, but to Dowland's works, which, you know, I love combining the two.
So any sneak peek at any future Baltimore consort projects that you can tell me about?
Sure. I mentioned that we'll be in Indianapolis in 2016. Mm-hmm. We have just we're finishing putting the final touches on a new program of music from the Shakespeare plays. And we are going to be rehearsing that after our Crossing to the New World performance in Indianapolis, and then premiering it at the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival.
Great. That's great. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come here and share all this great information about what's going on in this wonderful, lively, and vibrant early music world. Thanks.
Well, thanks for having me, Suzanne. It's always a pleasure.